Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning. Hello again. We are coming at you live from Vachon Island, Washington. This is the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show radiating from the beehive of creativity, civic engagement, and cultural awareness known as the Jean Bosch Voice of Vachon broadcast studio in the bustling and bodacious heart of our pastoral island community. That was the voice of our late founder, Brian Brown. Together we, the Brieflies, strive to keep Brian's brilliant flame alive by bringing you weekly episodes of quote-unquote intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy, always guided by Brian's mantra, less is more, more or less. Our Briefly panel includes Legal Beagle, mediator, Fulbright scholar, high fashion women's shoe salesman, and vocalist, Craig Bellis. Historian, professor, mariner, and guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Howellman.
Ooh, that's a new one.
I think, didn't I make a bad Halloween pun about that?
Oh, we could.
Yeah,
yeah. Yes. Several things.
Yeah, yeah. And we've also got fellow mariner, fellow mariner, backpacker, climber, cyclist, top secret engineer. I got to put that part back in because I like it. And rower Kevin Jones.
He's also wondering, why isn't there a high-end, high-fashion men's shoe line?
Maybe,
I don't know.
I think there is. Craig was not as fascinated by that.
No, there were. But, you know, I was selling Florsheim wingtips or something for the men.
That's what I was going to say.
Not exactly high fashion.
Yeah, okay. All right.
It wasn't Jacques Saint-Pinier, right?
No, nothing that the Pope would be wearing. But
that did go well with the gray flannel suit.
Indeed.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Fashionable.
Fashionable
women's shoes. All right. And then we've got Treetop Flyer, Vachon Airport Commissioner, our big board pilot, and mostly reformed Texan Truman O'Brien.
Mostly reformed.
Mostly. And I am part-time Politico, affordable housing advocate, Vachon Island Fire and Rescue Commissioner, but full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreyer. And today is what we affectionately call the Truman Show, a round robin of profound insight and local takes on today's hottest topics. But before we cover the news of the day, in our usual lighthearted but passionately serious fashion, let's first check in with the Brieflies and our about how things have been going. Kevin?
Day two of legislative session.
Yeah.
So, you know, us advocates for progressive change are all geared up about that, looking at, you know, microplastics in your clothes washing machines and all kinds of amazing pieces of legislation. You know, if you sit down and look at all the bills, I mean, literally there are, you know, like a few thousand, right? And all of the different topics, it's like, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's why we all focus on.
Yeah, you got to wait till cutoff. You really can't pay attention until it gets out of committee.
Yeah, but also this morning, and when you look out in town today and you see a number of people walking around, smiles on their faces, they may have been out rowing this morning on glass flat water as the sun was rising over Maury Island, shining on the surface of the water. A bunch of singles. We had a couple of doubles, but a whole bunch of small boats. And it's just fun out there cruising around, getting a great workout and some great coaching in the Vachon Island Rowing Club.
So, right on.
Totally, totally great way to start the morning.
Right on. Absolutely. All right. Bruce, how about you?
Well, been a good day to start with. This is my lovely bride's birthday.
Oh, yay! Happy birthday, Pam!
Happy birthday to Pam. So we had celebration with all the kids and grandkids this weekend. Hard when you're retired and all the rest of the family's working. So all the celebrations move to the weekend.
Yeah.
But it was also a great football weekend.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you're a football fan. And, I mean, it's it says something about how close so many of the games were. You know, that, I mean, when you get to that level and you get to the end of the season and the teams are clicking, any team can beat any team at any
Absolutely.
Time. It was just amazing to watch. And then, you know, I've never been an Aaron Rodgers fan, and it was great to see his career end with a pick six.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Karma.
Right. And then, of course, Saturday will be the Seahawks playing the 49ers.
5 o'clock.
Will be
five o'clock.
Is it the evening game? We got the evening slot?
5 o'clock. Yes.
5 o'clock. So that should be a great game. Yeah. You know, I'm sure San Francisco will come out with bears tied around their neck. They were so embarrassed last time by the Seahawks. It's going to be an interesting game. But today, celebrating Pam's birthday.
Cool. That's great.
Excellent. Excellent. And Craig.
Yeah, and I was going to say, that's a beautiful picture of Pam that you posted.
It certainly is.
On social media. Happy birthday, Pam.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had an interesting week. Last week, Thursday, I started my first guitar lessons. I decided to take up guitar with Daryl Redeker as my teacher. And we had great fun.
You don't mess around, man.
No,
you
no,
start with that.
Yeah, hey. Daryl's a great teacher.
Bass, acoustic, which way are you leaning on that?
Yeah. What's that?
Bass, acoustic guitar?
Or... the straight acoustic right now.
Okay, right.
You know, if I can't get my fingers into the frets, I might have to move to a bass. But where there's less less strings and more room.
Yeah.
That's the problem with having fat fingers. But, you know, I know guys who play like tambrizas and mandolins with these tiny little necks and a tiny little, and they've got big giant fingers. They go, how you do that? You know,
practice.
Exactly. So that was on Thursday, and then my weekend was punctuated by a trip on Sunday morning to the hospital to take my wife. She had AFib that was out of control. That never had that before, and it was we brought her. She came back last night. So it was an interesting couple of days. Now it seems to be back under control, but she's learning about that.
Oh, so uncomfortable. I'm sorry. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. How about you, Truman?
Well, on Saturday, you know, the Voice of Ashland is undergoing a major upgrade. We're going to be doing radio for television and all kinds of really cool stuff. And one of the things we had to do is clean out. There's this storeroom that we have out at Sunrise Ridge. It's called the Armory, the Armory. And the reason was because when it was a military base, it's where the light arms were stored. But anyway, we had to clean that thing out. And man, there's some antique stuff in there. It's got to go to recycling. I mean, it's horrible. But the other thing I did was I took Craig and our airplane up to Payne Field to get some work done. And I wanted to tell you about that because I find this pretty interesting. In modern, and I say modern, aircraft, ours is not...
ours is 1940s technology.
No, 1903.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
The first magnetos were used in airplanes in the Wright Flyer in 1903. It was designed by Charlie Taylor. And the cool thing about the magneto is that it's self-contained. It provides a spark for the spark plugs. And you don't need a battery. You don't need anything. You just, as long as the engine's turning, that thing will run. And so consequently, they've been using magnetos in airplanes since 1903.
Hence the spinning of the propeller by hand to get the magnetos to start sending the spark.
Exactly. Well, in about the 1920s, automobiles quit using magnetos and went to, you know, the coil and distributor, like, you know. And then probably, you would know this, Craig, when did
it electronic... started probably in the 70s. They started slowly moving over to electronic.
In the 70s?
Yeah.
Well, aircraft, being run by the FAA, they have not gone to electronic ignition until about, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, not very long ago. And when they first came out, you could put electronic ignition on one side, because each cylinder has two spark plugs and there are two magnetos. You could use one side, but you couldn't put both in. And the reason for that was because it needed electrical power. It didn't, they don't, these new electronic ignitions don't generate their own power like a magneto does. So if your battery failed, your engine would quit, right? So they finally got approval to put in two magnetos, but you have to have a standby battery to back it up. So we're getting new electronic ignitions put in our airplane. So we're going to finally get into the 21st.
I'll let you fly it back.
The
statistics are pretty clear that right after you do any major changes to an airplane engine is when most of the accidents occur.
Well,
we don't need any more of those. True.
No, we're at Painfield, so I am going to request the long runway so I can get it back on the ground.
It's not like a skipping pebble over the surface of the water, you're just thinking you'd have to have a return path.
That's kind of what you have to do, yeah. If you, with our airplane, it takes off pretty short. So I can get up and probably make two or three landings on that big, long runway before.
And we normally do make two or three landings.
Yeah. Well, you're supposed to get three landings every 30 days, right. Every 3 months.
We do it one.
Well, we can do it all at one time when we do it. Anyway, so that was what I did.
Excellent. Wow. Yeah. That always sounds so complex.
Well, it's kind of isn't.
That's moving from analog.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I support that whole backup battery. Seems like redundancy would be a great thing to have in the air.
Good. You would think
good
so.
Thing. Yeah. Good thing to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Just one more thing to go wrong.
That's true, too.
Fair. I did hear a story this weekend. Somebody knows a gal who was actually struck twice by lightning.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My aunt was struck twice by lightning, and she... right after the second time, she had skin whiter than white for the rest of her life.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I also learned about lightning. A horrifying thing that I never suspected is you can be struck by lightning inside your house.
I didn't know.
It can move through electronics. I know Aaron knows one gal who was in her house and it came through her microwave and got him. Horror. And then this other gal that I was learning about, it like basically reflected off of her windows, right? It hit and came at her through her windows. So there's something to be afraid of, right?
So check that grounding strap on your electrical system.
Although,
3 foot bar into the ground with the big cable. Yeah. Check that.
And stay away from the windows.
I had an FM antenna for my stereo. And a lightning hit the FM antenna and blew up my stereo.
Oh,
so I called up the insurance company and they said, no, you're not covered. And I said, it says lightning right in here. And they go, no, the lightning has to come into the house and hit the receiver directly.
Oh, come
on. Well, that can happen, apparently.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Well, I had a little discussion with them. We straightened that out.
I'll bet we did.
Get a little legally.
Are you still insured by that same company these days?
Yeah, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have two lightning stories. I took a hit on my
windshield.
No.
Your
satellite dish.
Sounds like.
I'll say it. Sounds like three letters. No, it's satellite dish. Took out every electronic in my house.
Ooh, I bet.
Including the TV. I mean, everything.
Blew it all up.
And it was pretty darn loud when it went.
Oh, my gosh, I bet.
Yeah. And insurance didn't pay for that either. But the other one was I was descending down into L.A. one time in the 737. I took a lightning strike on the nose. And, you know, we often get St. Elmo's fire, which, you know, sparkles and stuff all over the place. But this one was pretty good. It was very loud, and it lit up the cabin in the back. And about 3 seconds after, when I hear ding, 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 ding from the flight engine, going, what the hell was that? I said, well, it's just a little lightning strike, no problem. And it really was not a problem, except that the next morning we came out to the airplane and our computer was dead.
Oh,
and so we had to call dispatch and say, can we fly this thing manually back to Seattle? Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful day. They said, yeah, go for it. So we went with no computer or nothing.
Those days are gone.
Old school. Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that was a charged discussion.
Indeed.
I got them all day, guys.
High energy discussion.
Yeah.
That's right. All right. So
shocking.
Today in history, I'll tell you something shocking. Today in history, 1129, the Pope recognizes the Knights Templar at the Council of Troyes. Pope Honorius II grants a papal sanction to the military order known as the Knights Templar, declaring it to be an army of God. Take that.
Is that ice?
Right? Army of God?
Army of God?
Yeah.
History repeat.
Mm-hmm. Well, luckily in 1961, comedian Julia Louis-Dreyfus was born, who definitely would have had a great take on those shenanigans.
Indeed.
So I'd love to hear her do a tight 2 minutes on the Knights Templar.
Yeah.
All right. And then 1966, Lyndon Johnson appoints the first ever black cabinet member, Robert C. Weaver, as the head of Housing and Urban Development. And in 1990, Douglas Wilder of Virginia becomes the nation's first elected black governor. And I call those out because those are shockingly recent in our nation's history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Today is also Korean American Day, Make Your Dream Come True Day, and Peach Melba Day. So if you like Peach Melba,
today's the day.
Today's the day to make your dream come true.
Hey, I also saw that it was National Sticker Day, and I have no idea what that is. I did look it up, though.
Okay.
Yeah, I have no
Just
idea.
Just stickers that you...
I don't know.
Any kind of sticker. Remember Scratch and Sniff?
Well, we had...
Right?
That
could be fun.
What we used to call stickers in the grass in West Texas.
Oh, there you go. That's true.
So I don't know.
I doubt that's what they have. The sticker industry
has to have their day, right?
They do. Well, they need to be a little more specific there.
I think so, too.
About sticker day.
Read the fine print.
Yeah.
So hey, we're gonna try to set history tomorrow, actually. Mm-hmm. And so we have some historical figures who are lining up, like John and Abigail Adams, Ben Franklin, John Locke, and they're gonna be showing up at the Vashon United Methodist Church tomorrow, Wednesday, the 14th of January.
Nice.
Doors open at 6:30. Show starts at 7. It's actually a meeting of Indivisible Vashon. But those four luminaries are going to be in the standing up and sharing a little bit of wisdom from their time as they worked to create the country we now live in. And so show up and hear what they have to say. Deb Pierce McCabe is on board, as she is a literal playwright, and she's sort of helping to guide the effort. Brian Long is very involved with helping to make it happen. A full period costume. Period costume. My chat is blowing up with, where do we find the wig for Abigail?
I know. Well, 1448 is coming up, and with Granny's clothes, we are going to be short on props.
There you go. Yeah. So show up and check that out. Tomorrow, Vashon United Methodist Church, 7 o'clock.
Absolutely. And that feeds into...
I have a PSA as well. Starting next week at noon, directly after the Brown Briefly, is going to be a new radio show.
Mm-hmm.
30 minutes, 12 to 12:30. It's called Vashon 250. And Dr. Bruce Hallman is going to be one of the primary actors in that event. You want to tell us about it, Bruce?
Yeah, it'll be an interesting way to look at this revolutionary time 250 years ago and the things that came out of it and how it relates to us today and how it relates to Vashon Island. And the idea was John Flora, president of Voice of Vashon, came up with this idea, and Truman O'Brien is the engineer sort of keeping us on track, keeping us to 30 minutes.
Yeah, which is tricky.
but the idea is basically to look at events in that sort of 30-year period from the 1760s to the 1790s, from the Stamp Act and the beginning of revolutionary events what would become the United States, up to the adoption of the Constitution and the election of George Washington as the first president. And so what we're doing is we're sort of looking at that time period and using the Declaration of Independence as a kind of mission statement, aspirational statement. And the Constitution is kind of a user's manual. You know, sort of, how do you do this? And the tension between the two, because the Declaration is very aspirational. You know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. All men are created equal. The Constitution is, you know, three branches of government, supposedly, you know, and equal powers and balance of power, and sort of it's based on a hierarchy. You know, big states get more, you know, representatives than small states, but small states get the same number of senators as big states. So there's tension built in that between the ideals of the Revolution and the actuality of the Constitution. And so that's what we're going to be talking about. And then bringing that up into the sweep of American history, because those tensions exist all through American history. And then looking at today, what's going on in the current year that we're in, you know, last year and this year in the Trump administration, but then also relating it back to Vashon, because all of those issues that were dealt with in the revolutionary times have been dealt with through American history. We're dealing with them today on a national level, but Vashon has dealt with them as well. Mm-hmm. Over the sweep of the last, you know, 150, 170 years on Vashon. Mm-hmm.
And I highly recommend folks listen. I'm telling you, you're going to learn a lot. We've got the first two in the can. And, man, I have learned so much in two sessions, I can't tell you. And I'm really looking forward to the rest. And these are going to be one a week for the rest of the year, right, Bruce?
Yep. Yep.
Wow.
We're moving chronologically from the Stamp Act, you know, through all the kinds of events that sort of created the American Revolution. Right. And if you haven't, definitely watch Ken Burns' The American Revolution series. It's just an incredible insight into what the tensions were and the fact that it was a civil war. You know, there were tensions in the American colonies. Not everybody was a revolutionary.
That show really does point out it's not the colonists versus the Brits, and that's the end of it.
Nope.
It was a mess, and a war we almost lost about a dozen times.
It's the fragility of freedom, and we're seeing that today. You know how fragile, you know, the government that we take for granted. Or have in the past, how fragile it really can be, given people with an ideology that wants to destroy it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or seemingly, right? From, again, it's those perspectives. Where do you sit?
Right.
Right. Where do you sit? And what is destruction from where you sit?
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Those questions. So we've got, we're launching our very good America 250 discussion, I think, right here on Vashon. And that leads into my next question, Bruce, for you, which is, you know, over the new year, the Trump administration, which, you know, I think that's a stand-in for the federal government these days. I've mentioned lockstep, particularly when things go wrong, in my eyes, projected a video on the Washington Monument of depicting the nation's history. And of course, absent from that video, the America 250 kickoff video, absent from that were any mention of the Civil War, slavery, MLK, or you know, the references kind of what I think of as the glorious struggle, right, around our national identity and the fight to become an ever more perfect union, so to speak. And instead, the video focused on innovation and growth. And it opened, right, with Christopher Columbus sailing the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria to the New World for, as stated in the video, glory, gain, and God. The narrator goes on to say that America was founded, quote, not as an idea in the minds of men, but as a land discovered, unquote. I've always been taught that America as a nation, our great democratic experience, was in fact founded as an idea in the hearts of the people living here, not just men, right? So, Bruce, I feel like that is a loaded statement in that video. What are your thoughts?
Well, it is a loaded statement, but it is part of that tension. I mean, America, to me at least, is an ideal. It always has been. And the revolution itself was built around ideas and an ideal sort of society. And yet America is a place, you know. America in the European imagination was, you know, when it was first sort of contacted by Europeans, was an aspirational dream for many people. You know, wealth, power, you know, land, authority. I mean, all those things were built into it. So there's a dynamic tension in America. But for me, the United States, America as a country, has always been built on ideals. And there's sort of two fundamental documents that sort of set that up. And one, of course, is the Declaration of Independence, you know, that sort of idea that a new nation conceived in liberty, you know, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Those are the words from the Declaration of Independence. And that, you know, that government of, by, and for the people, you know, or, you know, shall not perish from this earth, the Gettysburg Address. You know, you've got these very powerful kinds of statements in the Declaration and in the Gettysburg Address that define to me who we are as a nation. I mean, we are in a location, but that location has changed. And that's why this sort of, you know, often extreme right-wing focus on land, you know, as who we are, has a false premise, because we weren't always the land that we are. You know, we weren't Alaska we weren't the West Coast for a long time. We were a narrow strip on the East Coast, and we weren't even one, we were, you know, 11, 13 different, you know, sort of governments at one point. So to sort of argue that we were one thing, we've never been one thing. Mm-hmm. And that's why those aspirational statements allow you to find unity around ideals, because there'll never be unity around place, because places change and places are different. So that's how I would respond to that.
And, you know, so obviously this is a very timely reference to, you know, Manifest Destiny, the Monroe Doctrine, right? All of these sort of old ideas that are coming new again in the Trump administration. But, you know, might we say, though, that westward expansion and prosperity, economic prosperity, have sort of been the engine that have allowed us to explore these ideals of freedom?
Oh, certainly. And but at what cost? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's sort of what you have to look at, is sort of like, yeah, definitely, you know, Manifest Destiny, westward expansion, you know, the availability of quote-unquote free land, you know, the frontier, the whole mythology of the frontier. Well, the land wasn't free. I mean, the land was occupied. The land cost, you know, cost in terms of treasure and blood to conquer it. And it took sweeping indigenous people aside. You know, so this concept of free land and sort of us as a manifest destiny was always built on a misconception, I think. Mm-hmm. Whereas what really ties us together, wherever you live, is this idea of who we are as a people, and that we do have a government by the people, for the people, and of the people. So, and if we lose that, then we're no longer who we are.
So contrary to J.D. Vance, perhaps you could say that America could exist anywhere on the globe.
And it does. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. Think about it. Who comes here to be Americans? People from all over the globe, because it is a shining light on the hill, but not a physical place, but a mental construct of, you can be who you want to be. Well, and that's not powerful.
You won't have to travel very far exactly. If the current administration has its imperialistic and colonialistic ways. The acquisition of property and the dispossession of individuals from that property has come around again, mm-hmm. Big time, mm-hmm. or bigly.
Mm-hmm. Bigly.
Bigly.
Bigly,
yes.
Right.
Bigly, yeah. Yes.
Well, and it's a return, in many ways, it's a return back to that Columbian time where the world was divided into spheres of influence. And, you know, in the post-World War II world, we had become very close to sort of beginning to dissolve that. And the United Nations was the expression of that. Now we see that, you know, that's being pushed to the background, and you're seeing the world being divided into three major world spheres of influence, back to that sort of pre-Columbian kind of time period. And that's, to me, that's scary, because that's what leads to conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what leads to war. And wars in the past have been devastating, but they never had nuclear weapons.
Yeah. I was just going to ask Bruce about, you know, what are the consequences of that move. And I was maybe thinking along the lines that you were saying. One thing comes to mind about wars is resources, right? I mean, we all hear now about the the key metals that China, for example, has been working hard to, you know, control that market, you know, critical minerals that are required for batteries and other things that are drive our modern technology future. Are there other things? Is it just resource acquisition, you think, historically is the thing that causes the conflict? Or
it's always been in my mind that all wars are economic. All wars are economic. You can talk about, oh, yeah, they bombed us and, you know, they really angered us and blah, blah, blah. Nah, it's all about economics. And it's and resources are a part of that, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Bruce?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say all wars are economic.
Yeah.
I mean, there's economic basis, but there's also very powerful emotional things that get engaged in war, particularly in revolutions.
Oh yeah.
And it's sort of that sense of who a people are.
Right.
And you look at that post-World War II colonial revolutions, where basically the colonial world, the Colombian world, was overturned in a matter of less than 100 years. The British Empire, which at the end of the 19th century straddled the globe, you know, by the 1960s and 70s was in shambles. There's an economic element.
I was going to say, but what drove that empire was economics.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
right. Yeah. Right,
well, there is the issue of religious. I wouldn't discount that in the least.
No.
But can you separate religion from economics? I wouldn't.
No.
Well, certainly they're intertwined, or as they say, inextricably intertwined.
Yeah. Well, economics, talked last show about the Tea Party, about the Boston Tea Party, and it was the tax on tea, right, that really lit the fuse. I think, Craig, to your point, right, that there are perhaps some inextricable, that economics is perhaps inextricable, right? Like, we instituted the Marshall Plan for a reason, right? Because the economic devastation that World War I, you know, wrought upon, you know, the European continent, we knew because of experience that economic devastation was going to lead, you know, foment unrest, etc. So perhaps economics and ideals are inextricable in war in many ways.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, as we're talking about America 250, what a great point of introspection. What a really, really interesting time right now, that today, this year is America's 250th birthday. And here we are in one of our greatest struggles for our, you know, the experiment, the democratic experiment, so to speak. And, you know, one of the really important, you know, World War II sort of, you know, post-World War II global constructs was, you know, international courts, right, and NATO and the United Nations and all of these sort of really, I don't know if it's correct to say sort of Western ideas of globalism, right, that became, you know, so dominant in the post-World War II era. But Craig, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the International Court of Justice. It's going to hear the genocide case against Myanmar next month for the bloody state campaign executed by the Buddhist forces against the Rohingya Muslims. And that was a little bit of a death knell, on my opinion, of the how religion and power are so often intertwined, right? That you see these, you know, Buddhist forces, right, really bloody, what we would perhaps consider amoral campaigns, and they're now up in the International Court of Justice for their genocide work there. So, but the International Court, it doesn't really have teeth, right? It doesn't have an enforcement mechanism. It's a moral exercise that we've decided to set up. So is that moral exercise? Is that that court, that trying a nation in court, you know, for what it's done, is it relevant in a world of, you know, multinational corporate oligarchs that are oftentimes setting political influence, and in the world of Trump, Putin, and Ping?
Well, you're right. The International Court of Justice does not have a really great enforcement mechanism. It relies on the states that are parties to the treaty, the Hague Treaty. The United States, of course, is not a party, nor is Israel, nor is China, nor is Russia. Well, Russia might be on that one. I have to double check that one. But you know, if it doesn't have any relevance, then we're done. Mm-hmm. It's done. I mean, we even though it may not be able to be enforced easily, and that's an understatement. The International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court, which was established here just 20 years ago, so are an ever present example of what we aspire to. And an attempt to maintain certain norms, which we see diminishing and being destroyed and ignored. Well, not ignored, but literally destroyed intentionally. So I think they do play a role. It's frustrating, of course. The International Criminal Court has warrants out for, you know, Netanyahu and Putin and various individuals in their administrations or their regimes, and they it's you know, people don't enforce it. The people aren't parties. The biggest people, like the United States, or biggest entities, like the United States and Russia, are not parties to those, and Israel are not parties to those courts. As a matter of fact, the United States has applied sanctions on some of those courts, and have really condemned their, you know, the fact that they don't have jurisdiction, and they don't, and they won't permit individuals who are investigating for those courts to even come into the United States. They won't grant visas to those people.
Is that a bipartisan? Has that been a longstanding policy?
Well, actually, there have been there's been some fair amount of criticism of the International Criminal Court that came right through from the Biden administration, but not to the extent it has been since Trump has been the president. But the bottom line is, yeah, it's frustrating. Are we going to put anybody in jail because of that? Well, not with the current leaders in the big countries. But does it serve a purpose? I really think it does serve a purpose.
But Craig, you know, I mean, we've talked about this before, but really all of our laws and our agreements all have to do with, we have to agree to do that. I mean, we have to agree to be a party of that, right? And if you don't agree to abide by the sanctions or whatever that's produced, what's the use? I mean, it's even true in our, I mean, especially right now in our country. I mean, when the Supreme Court says, hey, this is the way it is, and our administration goes, eh, you know, yeah, well, so, I mean, you have to.
It's as we say in the law with regards to a number of constitutional rights and remedies, it's the best worst alternative.
Exactly.
Have you got another alternative?
Exactly.
That's any better?
Right.
Well, not really. I mean, there may be, but out there, but without a general agreement, as you say, it's very difficult to enforce these things. But I'm a firm believer that you don't then abandon it.
No,
you've given in.
Well, I agree. Yeah. I agree. Well,
it's the Winston Churchill statement about democracy is the worst form of government, right, except for all the others.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't, you know, tune into the hearing where they had the debate on the pros and cons of the United States joining the International Criminal Court. But has anybody here, like, say, here's what the rationale was? Because it seems really hard to justify.
It's different to a certain degree. Its procedures are different. But the major reason is because we are very jealous in the United States of our jurisdiction, our ability, our power. Mm-hmm. Jurisdiction is just another word for power.
Sure.
Our power to remedy or not remedy, to look at things or look the other way from things. And we do not like, Europeans, for example, mm-hmm. to come over here and tell us that, you know, we want to arrest your president. and we think your government stinks and it doesn't abide by human rights laws. Mm-hmm. So we don't like sharing our criminal justice system.
Well, that was the whole reason that the United Nations was so difficult to establish, because no one wanted to give up their sovereignty.
That's right.
They don't want to give up their power that they have. So
does this tell us that all the little nations who have joined the International Criminal Court are there in alliance for protection against the big guys?
Yeah. Basically? Yeah, I think so. They've got more to lose by turning their back on those courts.
Right. The
United States has taken the position they have more to lose by recognizing those courts.
Sure. There you go.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so imperialism is not dead.
No.
Mm-hmm. It's not. We evolve in terms of multiple millennia, not decades.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. And if we step aside from our American perspective, perhaps the multitude of nations in the world are calling on us to be better, right? To do more, to be more just, right? Out there, and that certainly seems like a vehicle for doing that.
Power. Mm-hmm. I mean, people do not like to give up power, mm-mm. individually or on a nation basis. Mm-hmm. Once you got it, and once you're exercising it, and you're benefiting economically from it, you don't typically voluntarily give it up.
Right. And that one of the greatest questions before us right now, right? That's much of this sort of civil cold war that we're engaged in right now in America is about, well, why should we? Why should America give up anything?
Well, didn't your parents ever tell you to share?
But it's also important in the broader sweep of sort of human history, if you will, to realize how recent an event, the creation of nation states, or, the principalities and small, sort of kingdoms have existed for a long, long time. Yeah. But in terms of nation states and national identities, I mean, that's a 300-year-old kind of concept for the most part, 300-400 years old. That's relatively recent in human development. And so we're still struggling with that.
You raise a very interesting question. Mm-hmm. A recurring question that always comes to my mind. How did the Romans become Italians?
They stayed put.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Indeed. So nation is place.
When the Huns came in, they had to get together. And,
that's right. Yeah.
Well, also, but though a very great point of divorcing nation from place, right? The Romans became Italians, right? The idea of the Roman Empire fell. And yet Italy, as a, geography, remained in place, right? The idea of that place changed. And
the culture is what defines that not only the place, but the shared culture of the people.
Mm-hmm. So. Absolutely. All right. Now, Kevin, let's get to talking about how, from a certain perspective, we're here to defend what we think of as our democratic idea. So, we're very divided as a nation, and it's very much become along party lines about whether or not Rene Goode's murder by the state this past week was in fact a murder. And protests ignite nationwide, but will protest in its current form, right, scattered across random cities at random times, lasting for days and then fading away. Will that make a dent in the actions of a regime that is growing ever more emboldened, right? Like the moral imperative, what is our imperative to leave our jobs, our homes, our families, right? I can't just, I'm driven to defend our country, but At what point do I say I'm leaving Vashon household in the capable hands of someone else so that I can, you know, protest and really shut this down, right? At what point, when do I stop being complicit? You know, what do I sacrifice
when
in order
to... When do the guns come out?
Right? When do I... But, you know, even when do I... How much do I and when do I sacrifice in order to stop being complicit, right? Mm-hmm. In what we think of as, you know, Nazi Germany, right? That's... I know it it's not necessarily hyperbolic, but it can be, right? It's very polarizing, right? But we always say that the folks who were complicit were the folks who drove the regime. Am I complicit? What's my moral imperative, right? You're leading the charge here. You're helping us lead the charge to be responsible citizens. And I did want to just call out what I saw on, you know, the Department of Homeland Security and their new motto, which is one of ours, all of yours. Right, which has a chilling, absolutely indeed, chilling history mm-hmm. to it in terms of fascist regimes. You know, take a look on the internet, folks. So how do I not be complicit? What's my moral call?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple things there in this deep subject. Renee Nicole Good is one of now 36 people who've lost their lives at the hands of ICE. When you have that number of people, you're always going to have some number of illnesses and fatalities. But Renee Nicole Goodman died from 3 gunshot wounds to the head, based on what we can tell, from an ICE agent that walked in front of her car. And so in this narrative of she's a domestic terrorist, I wouldn't walk in front of the car of a domestic terrorist who was probably going to try to take my life. So there's that. About 200 or so islanders decided that they wanted to respond to this on Saturday, I believe, Sunday? Saturday. We had folks show up at the Village Green to just sort of share their reactions and perspectives. And then we moved to the four-way stop. And I'm sure Liz Shepherd was there, so I expect you're going to see some coverage of this in the Beachcomber. There might be something there now online. We recognized the number of people who are now dead as a consequence of some of the actions the administration is taking. Our choice is to not be complicit in the way to respond with the same type of atrocious behavior that we're seeing. I don't think the administration's going to change. I think that they're very determined. I think Stephen Miller, who's I think one of the architects of this, has a life history of opposing anybody who doesn't look like him in this country, and I think that's a key motive that he has. So, but I think it can change the people, and that's the important thing. Is it needs to change us. It needs to change us from being willing to be complacent around seeing a video where there's enough evidence to, if anybody suggests that it may have been that Renee Nicole Good was trying to run over an ICE officer, you've got to see how many opportunities she had and how few that she took, number one, right? So that has to change us, because it's not about a domestic terrorist. It's about how this administration is enabling essentially a police force to run rampant. Understand that the number of training hours is much diminished from what would normally be appropriate for a person packing lethal force in our communities, dealing with the public. And we already know that transaction between policing and security and the public is already fraught with all kinds of challenges, right? And so the amount of training and expertise that these folks bring is quite small. The recruitment, we're hearing their challenge to find enough people to join. I can certainly understand why. What it means is that standards are maybe not what we would all want. But that does not deter the administration, in my opinion. So the people have to change. But we don't want to, you know, bring out the weapons on our side, right? There's all kinds of examples in history of the fact that when you turn to violence, you lose the support of the people. Mm-hmm. And in a democracy, we need the support of the people. That is the fundamental truth, I believe, that we have to count on to move us forward, while at the same time preserving the foundations of democracy as we want to have it, free and fair voting, a process of deliberation that leads us to modify the rules of governance, like our legislative session right now. It's easy to take your eye off that ball and focus on the horrors that we see happening. Many of us view that as horrific behavior, but we have to do both. We really have to preserve the democracy through its institutions and also react and respond to things that we think are atrocious.
Mm-hmm. But will, right? There's definitely been turning points, right, in our history when state violence sort of ignited something new, right? You think about Kent State, for instance, and, you know, in some ways very small compared to what's going on right now. But, my question is, will this actually, or is this actually what many, many Americans want? Will this state violence actually not be a turning point, but instead a calcification, right? And I saw a kind of interesting take the other day, which was like, oh, right, of course. It's, you know, Trump is not president despite of America and who we are. Trump is president because of America and who we are. So...
Well, Sandy Hook didn't change a lot of people's thoughts about gun violence. January, the insurrection at the Capitol didn't change a lot of people's minds about who they wanted to vote for as a president. So you're asking a great question. I don't think any of us really know the answer. But well, I do think that it's maybe essential that this is the path that I would prefer us to be on. Reacting, raising awareness, looking at some of the things that we think is atrocious, and then doubling down on democracy and making sure that we do everything we can to get people in our leadership position and the government we deserve. And hopefully we'll be successful.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to comment this. You know, state-sanctioned violence is very different, and it's reacted to differently by American citizens than other kinds of violence. And there have been a number of cases in the past, you know, particularly with the Dred Scott decision, where the government essentially sanctioned slave catchers bringing slaves back into the South. Some of the sort of bringing the army in some of the labor disputes in the late 19th and early 20th century, those kinds of sanctions of violence by the government always led to a reaction by citizens. I mean, led to the Civil War, ultimately led to the Progressive Movement and the New Deal. And so, you know, I think such state-sanctioned violence brings with it a sort of challenge to authority that, you know, the random, if you will, violence, you know, the Sandy Hook kind of violence doesn't. And so it'll be very fascinating to me to watch how we spin out over this ICE violence, because it's state-sanctioned violence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, getting back specifically to the question you initially asked about whether or not you're complicit or could be, that is a recurring theme on Vashon. I'm going to bring it right back here to the island. I have lots of friends who say, I can't take the news. I can't watch the news. And I don't mean to be judgmental. I mean,
it's hard.
It is, because some people really emotionally cannot deal with that news. I feel I got an obligation to watch the news to find out what's happening, or I'm going to be a member of Vichy France here. Mm-hmm. And maybe because of my legal background, you know, I have more tools to deal with it, and I have a responsibility. There are a lot of people who one, are just so pained by the news that they won't watch it. There's a lot of people who say, hey, you know, this has all happened in the past. It's no big deal as we slide down that slippery slope. And then, you know, if I say say that phrase to them, they'll go, oh, Chicken Little, the sky is falling. It's not that bad. We've been through this kind of stuff before. And I go, well, I've lived 76 years, and I don't remember this happening before during my lifetime. It becomes normalized. Mm-hmm. It's like the what's the outrage of the day?
Yeah.
You know, oh, okay. All right. Well, you know, maybe we, you know, I don't, there's nothing we can do about it or whatever. Well, we can get out there and we can, I'm a big believer in demonstrations. I think they actually have had an effect on Donald Trump. on some subjects. So so I encourage people, get out there. It's fun too.
Yeah.
As long as nobody's getting shot. Or
it's heartening. It's heartening, right? Together. When we are together, we feel courage.
I think of the movie Gandhi, where they see these people being nonviolent, being attacked, and they just keep coming and keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. And eventually the powers that be begin to weaken because they just can't keep it up. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's kind of where we're at.
We're the zombies in the horror film?
Right, yeah, exactly. Right.
Yes. But if I could just add one other thing. I mean, there has been a loss of life, an activist on Vashon who brought firearms to the Northwest Detention Center a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. Look it up in the Beachcomber. That mm-hmm. person is no longer on our earth. Renee Nicole Good was basically kind of in a little bit in their face, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot about know your rights. There's a lot about understand how to be safe, a lot about what you can do. You can film, you can video with your camera. These events, you can see how powerful that is and how important it is to capture that information for law enforcement and for the courts to address these things. But you also were asking people to be safe and be aware. So if, we want people to raise awareness, we want people to document, to be present and see what is happening so they can convey that. But we also want people to be safe.
Right. Well, so. And it's that it hasn't come to our shores yet. Do we doubt that Seattle will come into the crosshairs at some point? Right. And then that question will become for us, when do we, jump on a foot ferry or jump on over and really, we have the ability to conveniently protest on Vashon, right? At what point will we be called to step up?
Inconvenient.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely.
I was interested in your concept of, Stephen Miller wanting everybody to look like him. Are we going to all have to dress like Nosferatu?
Right? Speaking of the zombie vampire hordes. Yeah, right.
When you said that, Kevin, I thought, oh my God.
There's a master race for you.
I did too. I thought, oh my God, not
yeah.
that.
All right, so we're going to have to do a lightning round here with you, Truman, right? Well, so we're talking Denmark, we're talking Iran now, we're talking Venezuela. There's a lot on the table. You've been to Europe in sensitive mm-hmm. places at sensitive times. Mm-hmm. What's going on over there on the continent?
Well, the one thing I always fall back to is, what we learned back 50 years ago was that NATO was not really formed to confront the Eastern Bloc. What it was formed for was, it's the old adage, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. And that's really what it was all about. We wanted to keep Germany in close contact with us and make them a part of the process. That was the reason, really the reason why NATO really got started, was to keep a lid on Europe, and in particular Germany. And from that grew this consortium, this group that now was facing the Eastern Bloc. And it's, I find that really interesting. And now when I hear Trump saying he wants to pull out of NATO, I think, are you absolutely nuts? I mean, that is what holds the Western group together is NATO. Mm-hmm. And
well, it holds back, but it holds back our power.
Well, it holds back Trump's power. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think our power comes from being a part of that consortium. I mean, it really does. I mean, without that, we don't have any power.
Yeah, and right, this is what we're discovering is the difference in opinion of what constitutes power, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So, all right, and kind of. Extending our conversation about democracy, Truman, next week we are going to have a member of the Fourth Estate.
Indeed,
here with
we are.
Us.
Yeah, Espen Anderson, who's our new editor of the Beachcomber, is going to be here. Really looking forward to chatting with her. I've met her once, and a very, very sharp young woman. And it's going to be interesting. I'm trying to put together our script now. Well, actually, I've been working on it for a couple of weeks. So if you guys want to jump in with a few questions, I'd appreciate that. So send them to me, and we'll get them passed on to her. So.
All right. Well, we have done, I think, a sort of a skim survey of some very deep topics today, but hopefully given some folks some hope and help in terms of how we think about and contextualize our world. So for Truman, Bruce, Craig, and Kevin, I am Amy, and we thank you for listening, and we will see you again next week here on the Brown Briefly.